The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry with Joe McGill.
Perfect. Thanks so much, Duncan. Thank you. I'll pop you on the line.
Good morning, good morning. How are you this morning? I'm Joe McGill and you're listening to the Saturday Supplement, and I hope I find you well wherever you are listening to us around the world on RadioKerry.ie or on 96 to 98 FM. What a beautiful morning it is this morning with all our bad weather and battering the coastlines and battering the county. It's like the county has woken from its slumber and it's shown off all its beauty, because I was, you know, Saturday mornings when I have to get up, because I'm down in Port Magee, and when I wake up, it's kind of the dark is hitting the light, and there was a beautiful red sky. I was looking at towards the McGillicuddy Reeks, and you could actually see the beautiful red sky. It was like an oil painting, like someone rubbed their brush across the sky with a dab of red. And what's that old saying? Not to put a dampener on it, but isn't this red sky in the morning sailor's warning or something like that? So hopefully it won't be anything like that. But again, this time of year, it's absolutely stunning because you can see so far, everything's so clear. And I've told you this, you know, on my drive up, I'm looking that I can see across to the Blaskets and see across to West Kerry. And then, you know, on to your right, when you're getting closer to the wonderful Killoglan with the Puck Goat, you can actually see over to the McGillicuddy Reeks. And I can imagine Kinmare beyond and coming into, then you're coming down over the mountains there and you can see over to North Kerry. What a beautiful place North Kerry is as well. So as you can imagine, I'm a bit in a good mood this morning because of the way the weather has changed. And not only that, I'm in a good mood because we've lots happening on the programme this morning. We'll have our third episode of Kerry Women in Sport, Volume 2, featuring Mairead Moynihan. Mairead writes for Ireland, regularly participating in international events that promote equitourism through horseback orienteering. And she has a passion for this sport, so I can't wait for you to hear that. We'll also, you probably heard during the week about Caught Jim. She features prominently in the earliest part of Peg Sayre's book, and this is where she declares Caught to be her dearest friend. But what happened to her? David Lowen will be on to tell us more about that. And we'll also have our Speaking of Poetry with Bernadette Ní Riadha, and this is becoming a very popular slot where we profile a particular poet. So I can't wait for you to hear that. And we're going to have Derek Mahon as our poet this morning. And we'll also be speaking to people involved in the Wild Mind Festival in Fianna, including environmentalist Duncan Stewart. Now, if you want to get in touch with the programme, 066 712 3666. You can text the WhatsApp 083 300 3300. I'd love to hear from you this morning. I have a few announcements as well, and I'll tell you about those a little later on. I'm kind of saying that to myself so I don't forget it. But first, let's talk about this wonderful event, the Wild Mind Festival. And to tell us more about this, it's taking place in Fianna from the 21st to the 23rd of April. We have Mike O'Neill in studio, and joining us on the line, we have Duncan Stewart. You're both very welcome this morning.
Thank you very much, Joe.
Mike, if I can get to you first, tell us about this event. How did it come about?
Wild Mind, I suppose, came out of, we used to be organising lots of different biodiversity events in Fianna over the years, and one particular year we had Eric Dempsey, who'd be a well-known birder and journalist, and he was doing a walk for us, and the first bird we saw was the meadow pipit, tiny bird sitting on an electric wire, and he said, that's the meadow pipit over there, and the meadow pipit is the host for the cuckoo. And then he went on to explain that due to changing farming practices, meadow pipit numbers were dropping, and consequently, cuckoo numbers were dropping. So that was the first inkling that there was, you know, all isn't well. And as we went through our walk, we saw various birds, and every bird seemed to have some story in terms of numbers under pressure, etc., etc. So at the end of all of that, I just felt we kind of need to have a space where we can just be thinking about nature and doing things related to nature that involve all aspects of life. As far as me, like, we have this idea of this separation from ourselves, from nature, and I just think it's just a bad idea because it's not possible. We live, we're part of nature. I am a living, breathing creature and I happen to be a human, but there's lots of other things going on around us. So anyway, in order to progress, I had an idea. I just rang a few friends of mine. I said, look, I'm thinking about this kind of a festival. So we got together and started shaping up an idea, and it just morphed into Wild Mind, which is, it's a festival about nature, but it's about community as well. And it's about how we can come together and do things as a community that are of interest to ourselves and others, and just, I suppose, talk about things that are sometimes uncomfortable, but also that we need to be advocating for nature in all its elements, because it's not just about animals, it's about ourselves, it's about the planet itself. We're here for a long time, but the way we're living at the moment is the wheels are coming off a bit, I think, you know.
Do you think, you know, I suppose, like, this is on with a few years now, and COVID as well probably interrupted this, like, a lot of events, but do you think we got more in touch with nature during COVID? Like, I know from my house, you know, you might hear traffic in the cars and things like that, but you were actually able to hear the birds and the bees and things a lot more. I don't know, it just seemed to open us up a lot more. And our 2 kilometres, you know, the way we had to walk, we had to take that in more.
It was such a unique time in history that basically we pushed pause on society and people were forced to kind of meet themselves in a way they hadn't before. I live in Phoenix myself, and I remember I could have laid down in the middle of the road in Phoenix. There was literally no traffic. It was a very unusual time, but it was also an amazing time, and I'm sure a lot of people have really special memories, because you literally couldn't go to work, you couldn't play sport. There was a load of things you couldn't do. And I suppose it was an idea for us to look at and say, okay, how am I living? And am I doing things the way I want them to be? Are they good things to be doing, etc.? So it was a time for reflection as well, and I think a lot of good came out of it. But in another way, Joe, we've kind of hit fast forward again, and we're kind of back to where we were in terms of how we've lived. Look, it's not easy to change how we do things, but we have to begin and at least try and talk about it.
And that's what this weekend is about. And Duncan Stewart will be going to it as well. Duncan, you must be looking forward to this. Firstly, I suppose, to go to such a stunning part of the world, to Phoenix, but also to spread, I suppose, a very serious message. And what do you hope to achieve over the weekend?
Absolutely. And you've just kind of really kind of excited me about the whole thing with your description there of a journey across Kerry, you know, in a beautiful, wonderful day. I just want to get down there very quickly. I was down there 3 weeks ago in out in Dingle. So I have been down recently and had some great times down there. So anyway, I'm looking forward. I won't interrupt you there.
Yeah, and what are you hoping to achieve then, Duncan, over the weekend? I'd imagine there's a lot of kind of, I suppose, education going on and awareness.
Well, I'm very conscious of the whole situation that we're facing into with climate change. You know, I think we as a society are waking up now. There is much more awareness around the country about what's happening and how serious the issue of climate change is. But we're not putting it into action, and we're not actually delivering policies that are going to make the change. Ireland's greenhouse gas emissions are out of control and are rising rapidly. And I had my grandchildren over here last night, and I'm just looking at my kids. They will not have a future beyond 2050 the way we're going. Their life is going to be incredibly, you know, interrupted by climate change. It will be the biggest issue in their life as we move through this century. And we are stealing their future now with what we're doing. And I think we're just not aware of how serious it is. We're talking about it, but we're not at all willing to change our lives. What we need is a total transformation in what we do. You know, we're completely living in the most unsustainable time in the existence of this planet. You know, we're out of control as a species. This, I'm talking about globally now, but here in Ireland, we're particularly bad. So I'm just trying to kind of alert us to how urgent it is that we all start to engage in our local communities, like what Mike is doing out in Phoenix and bringing into Tralee. I think the whole concept of the wild mind and nature, because we have the two big issues. We have the plummeting populations of wildlife, you know, and we, I mean, seriously, you know, when I was kind of in 20 years of age, the populations of wildlife were 3 times what they are now. We're down to 1/3 of what they were. This is all mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, right across we are destroying nature. But at the same time, the climate system now is going to be, we're heading into a 3.5 degree world unless we make massive transformations. And we can contain this massive juggernaut if we seriously, collectively address it. But we're not doing it. And our government policies are not strong enough to do it. And our opposition parties are doing nothing. And our independent politicians are useless when it comes to this. So we have a problem because it's our society, it's us as a people that are actually leading us. We're just blindly going into this disaster. And I mean, everybody's going to be, in 20 years' time, there will be nothing on the agenda other than climate change. Believe me, everything else. I mean, COVID, you were talking about COVID there a minute ago. COVID is only a little blip in what's coming down with climate change. Mm. So I'm trying to kind of bring it, and I'm very conscious of schools and young generation getting the message through teachers about how serious this is. So I've set up a thing called EcoEd for All.
Yeah, and tell us about that. But like, just as you're talking about that, it seems to me like we did a documentary called Plastic Generation about the harms, you know, harmful effects of plastics on our environment and everything else. But it seems to me that it's the young people get it. You know, they seem to be more aware than anyone. So so explain to us about EcoEd for All.
Yes, EcoEd for All really is a program that I've been putting together with others, about 12 of us, all voluntary, to bring information to teachers in second level schools. Now we're focusing on second level because the transition year has the flexibility, and we want to spread this obviously into primary school and everywhere. But it's we're trying to gear to transition year simply because they have the time, they have the flexibility within that year, because the Leaving Cert is completely off track. I mean, the Leaving Cert is leading us completely the wrong way, the way it's structured.
In what way?
It's the most damaging thing. Well, effectively, it's gearing that young generation into this greedy, competitive world of feeding into a system that is bringing us down to disaster. If you take Kerry, for example, it's like a one-way ticket out of Kerry, for example, you know, when you do the Leaving Cert. You do the Leaving Cert, you go on then into other things, and then it's not just that it's taking people from rural Ireland, but it is actually damaging our young generation, because once they go into third level, they're now geared into their careers and into this destructive thing that we're doing at the moment in the way we're going with everything. And we need to restructure our Leaving Cert to make it much more relevant to people in their local area, so that they can build a future in their local areas and that they can have a good life and protect us from the impacts that are coming down. And this is all to do with communities. It's all about people coming together collectively. Farmers, for example, are key to this because they're really important. And an awful lot of farmers want to engage in this, but they're not being given the right government policy to deal with this. At the moment, Ireland is all geared to export of beef and dairy in you know, and it's this obsession with that is causing big impacts on farmland. And we're just not making the connection of the damage that we're doing. You know, look at our transport. Our transport is totally out of control. Our greenhouse gas emissions in transport were meant to have gone down by 20% in the last 30 years. Our transport emissions went up by 153% in those 30 years, when it was meant to have gone down by 20%. Now, this is shameful. You know, so we have to kind of realize that we are living in this country in the most unsustainable time, you know, and we have to change it. And it means fundamental changes. So I'm passionate about this issue because I'm seeing it. I'm reading the science all the time. Mm. All my TV programs are based on the science. And it's so clear to me, you know, I'm meeting these top scientists and I completely understand what's coming down the track. And, you know, if I can't get my message out, then, you know, where are we going to go? Because we're not getting the leadership from our politicians. Mm. So I'm going to be very open and talk about these things.
Yeah, but do you think, like, you've been at this a long, long time, probably before, you know, like, you know, I suppose climate change is talked about a lot in the mainstream media now, for want of a better word. But, like, do you think that message is getting across, because, you know, it seems to be, you know, when Greta Thunberg came along, there was a big thing about, you know, it was all to the fore. But again, I don't know, it doesn't seem to be hitting like you're explaining it there now.
Well, I think our young generation, you mentioned, Joe, our young generation of school kids, they do get it, but they don't have the knowledge. They don't have the information. You know, just look at the physics. I was looking at reading the physics papers for the Leaving Cert the other day, and looking at the syllabus that's there. It has nothing in that science subject to do with climate change. And climate change is a science. It's all about science. I'm just saying that young generation are aware. They're trying to get their message out. They're fearful for the future. There's an awful lot of climate anxiety among that young generation because they feel stressed about their future.
But it's a global thing as well, though, Duncan. Like, you know, and that's often, I suppose, brought out there. You know, when we were talking about Ireland and localising, you know, I suppose the whataboutry argument. Look at the damage China is doing. You know, or other. You know, I suppose, you know, multi-capitalist countries that are. You know, it's all on big business and the damage they are doing.
Absolutely, but we, as a population of 5 million people in this country, our emissions compared to Africa are 80 times. Per person, the emissions of Africa. Our emissions compared to China are double that of China. Our emissions compared to India are 10 times that of China. You know, we're 10 times that of Ireland. We are kind of saying, okay, yes, the whole world is, but it's the rich in the developed world are doing disproportionately the most of the damage. Like, the top 1% of the world population, and there are people in the top 1% living in Ireland, they do 16 times the damage of all of the greenhouse gas emissions. They're like double the emissions of the lower 50%. Just that 1% is doing the damage. The top 10%, where nearly all of Ireland is in that top 10%, are doing disproportionately so much damage. We seem to want to kind of focus on, you know, I mean, there's 1.4 billion people in China. Yes, there's about 300 million of those that are very rich and doing huge damage, like we are doing in Ireland. But we're not focusing on what we've got to do. And we've got incredible resources here. Mm. We have wonderful, best renewable energy resources that we can tackle this with.
Yeah.
Our farmers could be doing so much good if they're only given the right policies.
Very good. Okay. We'll have to leave it there, Duncan, because I want to get on to Mike about this wonderful event as well. But you'll be there anyway, from the 21st to the 23rd, and you'll be telling people more about EcoEd for All, and we'll talk to Mike more about the other events you'll be involved
absolutely,
in. Yes. But for now, Duncan, thanks a million for coming on, and enjoy your time in Kerry.
Thank you for giving me the time, Joe. I appreciate it.
No problem. That's Duncan Stewart there. We're going to go to break, and Mike is going to tell us more about the Wild Mind Festival after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you in association with Sean Lynch and John O'Rahilly, Hogan's Funeral Home, Tralee.
Yeah, we're talking about the Wild Mind Festival that'll be taking place from the 21st to the 23rd of April in Finet. And Mike O'Neill is still with us. Mike, what are the kind of the highlights of the weekend?
Well, we have a whole range of things, Joe. I suppose we do things like we have films. We work particularly closely with a company called Crossing the Line Productions, who have world recognition in terms of the standards they produce. So we have two of their programs. One is called A Note for Nature, which is basically where they have approached musicians, artists, kind of thinkers, I suppose, and ask them for their kind of a 10-minute take on nature and the benefits that they get from nature themselves, and it's accompanied by music. We have a particularly interesting guy called Sean Renan, who has a company called Irish Wildlife Sounds. He's an ecologist by trade, but in his private time his ambition is to record all the bird life in Ireland, and he has this theory of what he does is he can tell from if a bird is a recent migrant, he can tell from its call what country it's come from by its accent. So he's kind of discovered that birds have accents, which is kind of really interesting. And he's very passionate, so he'll be really interesting and kind of quirky. We have a few panel discussions. Look, not all of what we do, the word festival is an important part of the title, because festival obviously is celebration as well, but we have to talk about things like Duncan was talking about as well, because they do impact on us. But we have family events, there's a lot of stuff for kids there. There'll be crabbing, there'll be archery, there'll be walks on the beach. We have John Edwards does sea kayaking tours. There'll be open water swimming. Mary and Alan Brown in Phoenix have they'll do boat trips to the lighthouse. We'll have well, the interesting thing we're doing is Jigsaw, which is the youth and mental health services in Tralee. They are this is a new branch out for them. They're doing a workshop called Wings and Roots, and basically it's about giving people, young people, the idea that nature is a support to them for your mental health. And I think that's a very important message, because we neglect that sometimes. And what I like about nature is it's completely not judgmental. I mean, what you described on your way here this morning was your interaction with nature and your place within that, and you could appreciate that beauty and it made you feel good about yourself.
Yeah.
That's a really important energy. So to impart that to young people, to say, listen, this is a tool in your kit here. If you're not feeling too good, take a walk, go for a swim, listen to the birds. All of those things are really powerful, but they happen about us and we don't even think about them. It's like what you said about COVID. It just gave us that time to pull back and say, wow, this is amazing. I live in an amazing planet.
Yeah, yeah. You were mentioning as well during the week, you know, Phoenix, I suppose, it's famous now for the Greenway that, you know, goes by there, and that's playing an important role in your event.
It sure is, Joe. Thanks for reminding me. Duncan, on the Sunday, the 23rd, we're organising a cycle from the train station, well, opposite the train station, all the way out to Phoenix. It's 13.6 kilometres. And I think sometimes the word green in the Greenway gets missed, but that's a big part of it. And so we're going to try and make this a fun event, that we'll have all different types of bikes, and we'll have a bit of music, and we're going to, Dunkel will lead out the cycle, and will take us all the way into Phoenix on the Sunday. And when people arrive, they'll be into the midst of the festival. And the other thing I would say is the car park has been changed around, so that it's, we'll have two structures there. We'll have what we call the barn, which is a large tent-like structure, and we'll have a tent. And in those, one we'll have music and talks, others then we'll have craft displays and various educational displays. Sorry, no, John, I'm gonna...
And we're out of time, really, but if there's any place where can people get more information, or if they want to go along, it's on the 21st to the 23rd of April, but where do they go for more information?
wildmind.ie, or just check us out on Insta and all the social media forms. We're hoping to have our program, it's very, very late, but we hope to have it out on Monday morning.
Yeah.
And look, I really appreciate the opportunity, Joe, for that you've given us to talk about it, because I think people will enjoy it.
Yeah, Wild Mind Festival, wildmindfestival.ie, and I always say about this, Google it and you'll find it, but it is on the social media as well. It sounds like an absolutely fantastic few days as well, and hopefully you get the weather as well, but sure, that doesn't matter either. It's like you said, there's so many different things going on. We'd loads to talk about you were on about the, you know, the transport option of the Greenway as well, you know, that it's a sustainable option, which
absolutely
is great here as well. But for now, Mike, thanks a million for coming on, and best luck with
thank you so much. Could I just
weekend.
Say one thing?
Yeah.
We have a person called Klaus Leidenberger coming down. He's a recognized organic grower, and I was reading an article last night, and he talks about soil, and he was saying in one fistful of soil there is more life than in the whole I mean, it's just full of life. So just think of a handful of soil in your hand, and there's more biodiversity in that. It's just very, very powerful image, that soil is that important to us.
Yeah, very good. Well, thanks, Mike.
Thanks again, Joe.
Best luck with the event. We're going to take a break with more after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry, brought to you in association with Sean Lynch and John O'Rahilly, Hogan's Funeral Home, Tralee.
Now we've lots of texts and calls to get to, and we'll get to them very shortly. But first, this is our third episode of Kerry Women in Sport, Volume 2, featuring Mairead Moynihan. Mairead rides for Ireland regularly, participating in international events that promote equitourism through horseback orienteering.
This documentary was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee.
What I really love is the horse and rider combination. But it is what it affords me to do, to be able to ride out in the countryside and to see the most beautiful scenery that Ireland has to, or whatever the country you're in, has to offer.
In this episode of Kerry Women in Sport, we hear the story of Mairead Moynihan. Mairead rides for Ireland regularly, participating in international events to promote equitourism to horseback orienteering. In addition to being the International Liaison Officer for Trek, she is also one of its founding members. Trek is an equestrian discipline originally developed in France in the 1970s as a way to improve the skills of trekking guides and horses. It has since developed into a sport in its own right, with thousands of participants across the globe. Among the many accolades Mairead has accumulated over the years, she won bronze for Ireland at a prestigious international equestrian event in China.
So my name is Mairead Moynihan, originally from Cork, but now living in Kerry for almost 30 years, just outside Tralee on the Listowel Road. So my father and grandfather would have been breaking horses, you know, for horse and trap in the locality. And that would have been what they were, that one of the things that they did. That was that, what they did at the time. And my father was farming. And about, now, he always had a love of horses, but farming in the 70s and 80s was, the horses were not in anywhere in the equation there. And then the government started to try and incentivize more Irish breeds. They started giving grants and things, and sure, he was off. He bought his first Irish draft mare, and from there on it was like breed a few more, a few Irish drafts and a few sport horses. But he wasn't the best at selling them on. He fell in love with them, so we ended up with a good few of them around the place. But I love them. It was, I think, it was always a dream, you know, the way you'd have a dream of what you wanted in life, to have a horse and a swimming pool. And so far I've managed the horse, and I don't care about the swimming pool. That's enough for me. Oh, I just love them. But then I was in you know, college and school, and that there was no time for riding, and they weren't for riding, they were for breeding. That's all they were really for. So when I came to Tralee first, I moved into the house with a few more, and two of the girls in the house, they were members of Kerry Riding Club. They were riding out in Eagle Lodge, Mary Bradley's in Eagle Lodge, in Gortclay. And that was it. This is my opportunity now. I was going to learn how to ride. So I started to ride there for a while, and riding their horses and things got on okay there. Took a break then for a while and tried out Kennedy's up in Ballard. And I rode there for a while, and that's really where I started to ride every kind of horse that came into the yard. Went hunting and everything with them. So that was it. Went back to Eagle Lodge then, because I decided it's time to get a horse. Time to move on. To be able to, more flexibility, to be able to move out rather than having, you know, I would have to be hiring a horse if I wanted to go somewhere, and transportation, all that. And I started then, I went home and said to him, you need to give me one of yours now here, come on. You have enough of them here, let's start. And brought down, and that was Brandish, so she was a sport horse. And started with her, and started to show jumping and dressage and cross country and hunted and beach rides, trail rides, anything. I loved being out. I loved being out riding. I loved working with horses. You know, just the combination, the pair. It wasn't about the show jumping, it was about the team. You know, it's a partnership. You know, you're only there because they let you up on their back and they do it for you. And in about 1999, through the riding club, I joined the riding club at that, and I was at that stage, and I was competing national level. And Trek was introduced into the country through the riding club. And it would have been one of the member of the executive, Orla Nolan, from down near Fermoy. So she said, look, this new sport coming in, do you want to try it out? And tried it there. And then, because we were interested in it, they brought over some trainers from the UK to show us how to set it up, how to judge it, how to run it. And of course, an invitation to, you must come over to and ride with us over. Now, it was going to be, we weren't taking the horses over. It was pointless doing that. But if anyone who was up to hiring a horse, and I was going, I mean, I'm used to this. So I hired a horse over, and over to Wales we went, and it started from there then.
Trek competition is based on a point system. So how does it work?
Trek stands for here Tourism Related Equestrian Competition Ireland. So that's Trek Ireland, the organisation I'm involved with. And Trek is really orienteering on horseback. It is totally tourism based. It is all about seeing the countryside from the back of a horse. And it's a two-phase competition. So the first phase is riding out in the countryside, following a map, following a route on a map, for anywhere from 16 kilometres to 45 kilometres. Followed by the second day is a series of obstacles. The type of things you'd come across if you were out riding.
Mairead's first Trek event was in Wales.
I went with another Cork woman. She was barely riding. But she was used to, I think she worked like an archaeologist for the county council or something like this, because she was used to features. Sure, I hardly knew map reading. Turn it over, kind of, which side is it? And, you know, what are these? We didn't even know what motorways were or what passovers were. Sure, I wouldn't be used to those. Anyway, off we went anyway. And it was the most sociable. That's the thing about Trek. It is so sociable. We went off as a pair and we just laughed the whole ways around. But it was making the friends and the connections there that started off what we have in Trek is the, we have the Welsh-Irish Friendship Trophy and the Welsh have the Irish-Welsh Friendship Trophy. And it was for, it was brought over by the riding club to them to signify a friendship between both and a start of a sport. And it's given every year and presented every year to somebody who has made outstanding contribution to the sport. It can be as a rider, it can be as an organiser, but it was us who brought it over to there. And I think it was about 2002, and they came back in 2008 with their trophy, their version of it. So it's I love seeing that trophy being presented, because it really goes back to when Trek started.
In Trek, the relationship between horse and rider is vital. In a lot of cases, it's a hire horse you're using, so you have to develop that relationship pretty quickly.
The minute you meet a horse, you're already setting the tone for how things are going to be done. So he or she's going to have their way of doing it with their owner. And once you meet a new horse, it's a case of, okay, these are my commands. It's the way you walk to them. You give them the confidence that you know what you're doing. And they'll go, okay, let's try her out. And you go, take her out for a nice handy walk. I am not for charging off the minute I sit on. I'm for, this is stop, this is walk. This is turn to the left, turn to the right, and okay, you know my signals now. You know what we're going to do. We're going to take it nice and easy and nice and handy and no messing. And the very second a horse starts to mess, you know, because they're going to try, you know, what if I shy at this? It's the back to, I'm not scared, you're not scared. Come on, we can do this together. And over time, I'm getting more and more used to reading them and say, okay, this is one I can work with. Or it's very rarely I would have come off one, as in said, I'm not going to. I can't remember getting up on one and saying, I can't work with this. There's always there's a willingness. If they're already taking another rider, then there's a willingness to work with a rider. And from the other side, those that are giving me a horse, it's not in their interest to be seen to have a horse that's in any way mad lunatic or has dumped a rider or whatever out in the countryside.
Mairead's involvement in Trek has brought her all over the world.
I've ridden in, so it started in the UK, England, Scotland, Wales, of course, a good few times. And then we ended up going to prepare for the Exmoor 2006. I had made a connection with one of the girls. She was a German. We had met her in Portugal. She was the daughter of one of the German trainers, and she was 16 at the time, and she decided she was going travelling. And of course, she was using all her father's contacts. There were all the other trainers, Trek trainers. So she met up with Bastian, my colleague, who lives down in Glengariff, a German. And because she was German, she arrived down to Bastion for the summer. And I got a phone call to say, Maria, just come down and collect me. I'm going to spend the rest of the summer up there. So Lena was her name. And Lena arrived up and we showed her all of Ireland. Mainly Kerry took her down to Dingle, and just while she was here for a couple of weeks, and off she went. And we kept in contact. So Lena, I went over to her a few years ago, and I've ridden in. I started riding there with her to prepare for Exmoor, and her parents, the trainer, their competitions, they had a competition in their place, and that was my first experience of seriously long, level four, orienteering with a compass out in the German countryside, and unable to understand German. I don't have German, I have some French, but it was an experience. It was definitely an experience. I've gone back to Lena, and a few years ago I rode A really special one is riding in the Black Forest on a Black Forest horse. Her uncle-in-law breeds, and they're very like drafts, maybe the traditional Irish horse, a little heavier, but it was just like, this is a true Black Forest horse, and riding it in the Black Forest. And now that's a beautiful one to be able to say. I've ridden in France, this is this year. I didn't ride in Italy or Spain, haven't ridden there yet. Ridden in, yes, in Holland, and twice in China. Once horses go into China, they are not allowed out. So there's no bringing horses into China. They stay in China. So a lot of the retired horses, top eventers, show jumpers, dressage, they buy them once they're retiring and take them into China. And so that's not what we had, though. What we had was Mongolian horses. Average height, 14 hands. Now, I'm about 6 foot tall. So that was funny. They built a whole festival around it in Weifang. So we had a carnival festival. This was where we were, out is northeast of Beijing. And the horses were brought down from Outer Mongolia. So as I said, they were fairly small. They were left out around the country. There was no fences where they came from, and they were landed into sheds. Had never ever done trek and knew absolutely nothing about it. This was run on so our competition was on the beach. They had never seen the sea. They'd never seen water that wasn't a stream, not even a lake, but streams or drains or things. But they had never seen tidal. This was not. But sure, let's figure it out. So it was the funniest thing that I've ever been part of.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you in association with Sean Lynch and John O'Rahilly, Hogan's Funeral Home, Tralee.
You're listening to an episode of Kerry Women in Sport, where we hear the story of Mairead Moynihan, an international equestrian rider. Mairead has many wonderful memories to her involvement in Trek. One particular one stands out. In 2022, Mairead was unable to bring her own horse to compete in France due to injury. However, through a twist of fate, she got a French horse in the morning of the competition.
A French judge arrived with a horse box with this horse for me. Dune was her name, a beautiful white horse, and she just unloaded her and handed her over. She didn't have any English, and I had very little French, but enough to understand both of us. We had a translator, dragged over a rider and made her translate, and she says, she's your horse now, you can decide what you want to do with her. And no instructions as to, she said she does endurance riding. She does a little bit of trek, but nothing other than that. And we took her into the arena for, I would say half an hour. That's all, because we had to prepare her. She'd just been pulled out of a field. She had to be washed and groomed and full presentation for vetting. So we did that. She passed her vetting. Her next job was to get ready for to parade through the local town in a 100 or more horses all together. We managed to do that. We rode out the first day. Her owner was the judge on the orienteering and was in tears when she saw the two of us arriving into her checkpoint. And I had a hard time getting her out of that checkpoint because her owner was so delighted, she wanted to keep her there. But we made it all the ways around and came home safely. Took us a little longer, but then I was enjoying this. She went the fastest I've ever ridden a horse. I mean, there was wind blowing back. The countryside was stunning, and she was so gentle and such a lovely horse. I actually thoroughly, I lost my points along the way, but I was absolutely enjoying this experience. The following day, and we came home safely, and her owner was ecstatic. She now had a horse that she could say her horse had competed in the world championships, and So she was absolutely delighted towards the end. There was hugging and kissing and more hugging and kissing, and the horse was just in the middle of it, and she was absolutely delighted. And the following day, she was collecting us at 7. She was collecting, leaving the competition, going home. And so we were there in the morning, which we would have been anyway, feeding horses, and pulled out, Dune was her name, this beautiful, beautiful white horse. And the owner was there, and she started plaiting her mane, and I was going, oh, it's an unusual thing. I haven't seen this going on before. I watched her plaiting it. I'm holding the horse, and Elaine and Francis are there, my judge and co-rider. And the next thing I noticed, and she pulls out a scissors and goes, what's she going to do now? And then I clicked. She's actually cutting the plait. And she cuts off the plait and hands it over to me and says, in what way? I know what she meant. You're taking part of her home with you, because she belongs. You belong to each other now. You, when you come to France, you have a horse here. Don't ever worry. You contact me, you have a horse to ride in France. You take part of her with you. You are a team, whether you're here in Ireland or in France. And the tears just started rolling down my face. I couldn't believe it. She was in tears. I just couldn't believe I'm coming home with this piece of this beautiful horse. So we get home, and Elaine, my friend, had been telling me about, she had had a ring made of the hair from the tails from one of her horses. And she said, this Irish company, Mane and Tails, based in Kildare, were making jewellery from horsehair. And came home, and another competition horse of mine, Tara, she had been in Exmoor in 2006, and she'd also been in Austria in 2010. They were world championships. And this plait Tara had passed away about 2 years ago, and I had kept part of her tail. I had never any intention of doing anything with it, only that I think she was part. I had part of her in the house, and I knew she was still with me. Might be silly, but it was sitting on the windowsill. And when I got home, I went, the two world championship horses, that's what I'm going to make with them. I'm going to contact this woman. And she combined the two of them into a bracelet, which I wear. It's my two horses are with me. So I've got the two countries, France and Ireland, and they're just closely linked through that bracelet and all the memories that go with it.
It's quite obvious from listening to Mairead, she loves this sport. So what are her hopes going forward?
What I really love is the horse and rider combination. But it is what it affords me to do, to be able to ride out in the countryside and to see the most beautiful scenery that Ireland has to, or whatever the country you're in, has to offer. There are just, I can see memories of riding across the top of the mountain and looking down at Alahees and looking out at the Atlantic, blue Atlantic Ocean, and just seeing, you know, like, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity. We have riding through the Bluebell Forest up near the Slieve Blue Mountains. I've seen so much of this country, and we've gotten so much access. It is just amazing. And I just wish everyone else could do the same here. I wish we had the same access they have abroad. And to just be able to just pack your horse into the box and just travel wherever in Ireland that you can, and just ride and appreciate this beautiful country. We're doing it with cycling and walkers and greenways and blueways. But this is a place where we have to have Ireland. This is the land of the horse. We have to have riding ways for here. Like, we need to start thinking about it. This is a huge tourism impact. Like, it's an untapped resource here. We have centres here and there that you can ride within. Like, we're now being pushed off beaches. You know, I want to expand this. You're on the continent. They're already expanding this. They're so far ahead of us. It's frightening to see. Like, they have the route to D'Artagnan, you know, D'Artagnan of the Musketeers in France. And all of this started from our point of view, really, looking at them going, they have France all the ways down. You can ride all the ways down to Rome. That's one of their rides, starting with the route D'Artagnan. They have countries like Belgium, Holland, Denmark, who are trying to link on and create their own routes. Now in the UK, you've got the Trans Wales that are hooking on to that. and we are left out here on the edge with no link, and we're going, we have to create a route that travels all through Europe, including us, but we have to sort out our side first.
Morehead shows no signs of slowing down and hopes to keep competing long into the future.
I certainly will. I have two horses. I've planned my retirement already. And by that I mean I've got a horse who's about 8 or 9 now, and there are 2 mares that I have. So I still have breeding potential in those two until, I guess I can get a horse out of them until I'm about 70 to 80, I think. Since horses last about 30 years, I just have to make sure that, you know, they're I just have to keep them riding well, and that's it.
That's Maureen Moynihan, and thanks a million, Maureen, for contributing to our series, Kerry Women in Sport. We're going to take a break for the news, and I'll join you again in the next hour.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you in association with Sean Lynch and John O'Rahilly, Hogan's Funeral Home, Tralee.
The Saturday Supplement with Joe McGill on Radio Kerry.
That's what you're listening to, and I hope you're enjoying the programme. A few messages and calls and texts to get to. Just to mention, Thomas O'Callaghan, no stranger to this programme. You'll remember that he launched a CD, or he was in the middle of making it there the last time we were talking to him. Hi Joe, hope you're well. I just want to mention, launch of the CD Outside the Box at Binner's Hotel Dingle on Friday the 21st of April at 8 p.m. Launch by Paul Ganey, Kerry Football, of course. The Clare All-Stars Band, Lawrence Courtney and David Ganey, will be on stage. All proceeds to Kerry Cancer Support Group. So that is going to be a wonderful evening there, Friday 21st at 8 p.m. At Binner's Hotel. Did I say outside Binner's Hotel? I don't think I did. It was Outside the Boxes at CD at Binner's Hotel. So make sure to go along to that, because they are raising much needed funds for the Cancer Support Group, and the bus there is what it's for. So it's always good to have a specific fundraising cause, and that's what it is. So well done to them. And I also want to mention the group from 135 Kerry Irish Pilgrimage Trust. Mike O'Shea was on to me to tell me that they're back from Lourdes, and they couldn't go to Lourdes for the last few years because of COVID and everything else. So hello to all of you that were in group 135. You all do brilliant work, and well done. I hope you had a great time in Lourdes, and we might talk to you sometime about your great time that you had over there. And also, just to get to a few messages, we had Duncan Stewart on, and there was a few messages in relation to that. West Kerry listener asks, has Duncan any concept of reality? If you consider the population ration between Ireland and China, of course China will be a bigger emitter. Africa, in the poorer regions of Africa, there is no machinery, no factories, so they will not be a big polluter. Hello Joe, I'm jealous listening to your description of your travels this morning. I wish I were there. Hope the weather improves for me to visit beautiful Kerry. And that comes in from Margaret, and hopefully it will be. Please God it will. I think it's going to start picking up from next week on, we'll say. Best wishes to Mike and all the team at Wild Mind Festival. And that comes in from Sean Lyons in Tralee. And just to get to a few more of your messages. Hi Joe, swallows have arrived before the cuckoo this year in Ballybunion. And that comes in from Helen O'Sullivan. Is that a bad sign when the swallows arrive before the cuckoo? I'd be interested to know more about that, and loads more messages which we'll get to very shortly later on. And she has arrived in the building. Bernadette Nerida will be in, speaking of poetry, and I'd be interested to get her insights into this next guest we've on, because in recent days, and you would have heard about this during the week on Deirdre's programme, the inhabitants of Dunkeen have marked the 150th anniversary of Peg Sayre's birth. Caught Jim features prominently in the earliest part of Peg's book. She declares Caught to be her dearest friend, but what happened to her? Dave Lohan is on the line and has been researching this to tell us more. David, you're very welcome. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Joe, and I'm very good. Thank you, and thanks for having me on.
So, I have to admit now, Peg Sayre's is before my time, but I know anyone I talk to, they don't respond well when I bring her name up sometimes. Okay. And others do, but you know. Who was Caught Jim, and who was she at all?
Okay, so I suppose if you had the, I suppose, the privilege back then of doing, particularly for the Leaving Cert, of doing Peg Sayers' book, and it was fine Irish. I think, you know, that's one of the things that Peg did, was she contributed. She had very good Irish, and that was the importance, really, of her book. But in the four of her book, she talks about her courage Eilish, Cáit, Jim, her faithful friend, Cáit, Jim. And so they were great buddies. And she kind of immortalizes Cáit by what happens when Cáit goes abroad, in that in about 1889, Cáit heads off to the United States. And Peg records how she accompanied Cáit as far as Dingle. And that she says in her book how she said, I'd only just wiped away the tears from my eyes, and Cáit had already disappeared from my sight. And that was largely the end of Cáit, Jim. So she kind of leaves in a fairly spectacular fashion early on in the book. And in ways, by doing this disappearing act, and by the fact that Peg had written her book, she immortalizes Cáit in ways, because Cáit becomes an unanswered question. So anyone who reads the book, Peg, will always have the question, well, whatever became of Cáit, Jim?
And whatever became of her?
Well, until now, we haven't really known. And that was the thing, essentially, that there was no lead. A letter did come, we know, from the United States to Peg, and she mentions that in her book. But for 133 years, the question has remained open. So I've been doing a bit of research. I do a lot of work on family history in my spare time. And some of the skills that I've learned through that, I've applied to the question of Cáit, Jim. And so based on some initial findings, I approached a Galway-based genealogist by the name of Martin Curley, who does a huge amount of work in this very area of genealogy. And we've continued the work from there. So we found a candidate in the United States who was really, really interesting. We knew she was from Dunqueen. We knew she was born around 1872. Cáit was born in 1871. We knew she had a sister, Margaret, this person in the US. Cáit had a sister, Margaret, who was a few years younger, and all that tallies. And there were various other factors. So what it looks like happened to Cáit was that she went to Pennsylvania, where she stayed for a while. And then in 1894, she was married to a man. And significantly, he was also from Dunqueen, which further strengthens the case that this is Cáit, Jim.
Yeah, it's fascinating to hear the lonesomeness, you know, you described there. Like, I suppose it impacted many Irish people leaving, and the kind of heartbreaking image of wipe away the tears, and then your friend is gone and gone forever.
Yeah, and that was it too. And Peg describes in her book, and it's very potently described, how it was the custom of the people of Dunqueen to walk a part of the journey, the first steps. All the immigrants, and these were, you know, there were events in themselves. But she describes how there was a place called Oct, and it was a heap of stones, essentially an ancient stone. They would go that far, so all the neighbours would assemble, they'd head off, and of course, what started off as a kind of an event or a joyous enough undertaking, the mood very quickly changed as it came to an end. So there were sorrowful embraces exchanged. And then as each party turned away, they knew they'd never see each other, really. And Peg records in the book, she said, the chances of seeing a person who headed abroad again was, she put it, 1 in 1,000.
So have you made contact with her family?
I have, yes. So yeah. We've had some assistance from a person who's a descendant of Kate Boland, this particular Kate Boland in the US, and the person that we firmly do believe is, or actually was, Cáit, Jim. And she's actually very kindly sent us a photograph. So we have a photo of an aged Cáit, Jim.
Yeah.
So not only do we know what happened to her, we actually can put a face to the name.
Yeah. And like many that's left, she never made it back, obviously.
No, and that was it. And it looks like her sister Margaret went out sometime after her. And we know that Margaret joined Cáit in her old age. Margaret became part of Cáit's household. And Cáit died in 1950. Her sister Margaret died then in 1951. She'd actually moved. They'd moved to Cleveland, Ohio. So Koch is actually buried in Calvary Cemetery in Cleveland, Ohio. But it was a little lonely enough thing. And I often think about, you know, people left, you know, small rural places, and they headed across the seas to a place they didn't know. I mean, I can't even begin to imagine what they thought when they saw these high-rise buildings and these mass of cities, you know, and before them. Mm. So it must have been an absolutely enormous change. And not only that, but, you know, you left so much behind. You were tightly integrated into your community, you know, your neighbours, your friends, and your family, and all of that was gone. And I suppose nowadays we can take a lot for granted in that we can pick up a phone, we can FaceTime, and we can do all these other things. But back then there was none of that.
Mm. Personally, for yourself, it must have been a great project to be kind of involved in, to get the answer as well, because sometimes you might not get the answer.
Absolutely, and I tried before some time ago to see if I could locate, you know, Koch Jim, but that there was no results from that. But certainly, yeah, there was satisfaction in finding someone and thinking, well, hang on a minute, now this person looks really, really good. So there's a lot of things that, you know, a lot of, as you go on, the pieces fall into place. So yeah, there's satisfaction in it, and particularly, I suppose, my own aunt was an Irish teacher. So were she alive today, she'd be thrilled to find, you know, to know that. We'd found Koch Jim, you know.
Mm. So. I wonder, will there be a kind of a reunion of Koch Jim's family coming back?
Well, you never know.
To West Kerry.
That's the thing, I suppose. That is the interesting thing. I think, you know, I was asked by Deirdre the other day just about, you know, what is the future for that, and I suppose thought more about that question. And I thought, really, I suppose it would be the people of Duncreen and the area of West Kerry. You know, the people of West Kerry. We'll probably write that part of the story, I guess, you know, what the future will be for Koch Jim. One of the things that we are trying to do, Martin Curley and I, my fellow researcher, is we are trying to contact people who are descended from Koch's siblings. So she had two who stayed in Ireland, John and William. Mm. You know, we'd very much like to hear from them. We have an email address that people can contact, or, you know, those siblings.
Yeah.
Our descendants can contact. It's KochJimResearch@gmail.com. So, you know, and that might help us then put the final pieces of the picture in place.
Yeah, so what are their names again, and what is the email address? Just give that out one more time.
Okay, so the email address is KochJim, that's C-A-I-T, Jim, J-I-M,
yeah.
research@gmail.com. And there were two siblings. So Koch had a brother, John, who was an older brother. He was born, I think, around late 1860s. He had family, and they all, a lot of them stayed in Ireland. She also had a younger brother, William. And again, he had family, and many of those people stayed in Ireland as well. So there are descendants of Koch Jim's family.
Mm-hmm.
In Ireland, and we'd very much like to hear from them so that they might help us complete the final steps.
Excellent. Well, thanks a million for coming on, David, and telling us about that fascinating story. And it's a story with a happy ending, and, you know, it sounds like she made a great life for herself out there, and also that you found out about her. It's a happy ending for you too, and hopefully it leads to more. That's kochjimresearch@gmail.com for any more information on that. But for now, David, thanks a million for coming on.
Thank you, Joe.
Very good, yeah, very fascinating into that woman. Bernadette Nirida has joined me in studio, but we're going to go to a break, and I'm going to find out about Peg now. Has she any relationship with Peg Sayers? It'll be interesting to get her insight on that. We'll take a break, we'll have more after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you in association with Sean Lynch and John O'Rahilly, Hogan's Funeral Home, Tralee.
Yes, that's what you listen to. If you want to get in touch with the programme, you can do so. There's various ways. You can phone 066-712-3666. You can text the WhatsApp 083-300-3300. Agnes from Kells, famous B&B owner, was on to me about the Scaravine during the week. And someone else has text there now and said, is the Scaravine starts today, 15th of April to the 15th of May? Question mark, question mark, question mark, question mark. I don't know, is that in from Helen again now? But I was looking here online. Old Irish folklore tells us the Scaravine is Mother Nature's payback for the cuckoo. The cuckoo arrives in Ireland expecting a warm spring, and it goes on. Then there's a whole thing. Farewell to the rough month of the cuckoo. And that it has been a rough month weather-wise. Bernadette Neary there, how are you?
I'm good, Joe, thanks.
You're here for our piece, speaking of portraits, lot, but I have to bring up Peg Sayers there now because we were talking about her. But just during our conversation there with David, it did kind of reinforce, I suppose, people that left that time, they never came back. So, you know, you had the Irish Wake kind of a thing that they were leaving, and it was maybe a celebration for the first years, but I'd say the dawning of that they're gone and they're gone forever kicked in then.
Because he was saying there, sorry, I can't remember his name, but
David,
he was saying that the custom was maybe to walk apart.
Yeah.
And to me, that emphasised the trauma. I mean, the people that left and didn't come back, or just the fact they were traumatised on the double, I think.
Mm.
First of all, they knew that this is the last time probably they'd see their family. But then if you think what they had to try and negotiate a new world, effectively. So they were doubly traumatised. Mm. And I mean, the loneliness, even thinking about it now and talking about it and listening to David, like, you have to kind of put your mind into that place. And we can, you know, it's hard for us because, you know, the planes and you're booking flights and all that, but jeepers, it was a death, really. And that's why I suppose it was the American Wakes and, you know, I suppose that's why it was called.
And then there's the other side of it where, you know, as a young person, you're going on this adventure. You've never seen the place. You think the streets are paved with gold if you listen to the songs.
Mm-hmm.
You know that you're going to be a multi-millionaire when you arrive over, a movie star. And what you arrived over to was a tough world.
Yeah, the reality was completely different. It was romanticised, maybe, or maybe, you know, you might hear a vague notion that someone was doing good, such a place. And of course, they go off and think that would just happen. But you're like, they had to break into and make their own kind of break into the skin of that society, and it was hardship, and there weren't always you know, even Irish speakers, and we know this from history and everything, like that, no one knew what they were talking about, and they you know, some of them were on the gutter in the street because they couldn't connect in with, nobody knew what they were saying, and they didn't know what anyone else was saying. So like, for some of them, they left to escape poverty and hardship, and I think that it's what they got, you know, it's what they experienced. I don't mean it's what they got, but it's what their life became. But now, I'm not saying that to happen to everyone, but so it was just the traumatic kind of frame of mind they were in, you know. And as you say, Joe, thinking that I get here and life begins.
Yeah.
And sadly, you know, it wasn't this sunshiny romantic view that they had maybe in their heads, or expecting everything to be better the day they arrived, you know. Because, like, it's different now because Google and information and everything, and you'd be kind of wised up before you'd make a big decision. But they were not innocent, I think, really. Totally innocent.
I tell the story about my aunt went over to America. That's not too long ago in the overall grand scheme of things, but that her aunt sent a dress back to her so that she'd wear that so they'd recognise her when she got off the plane then, because they didn't really know what she looked like. But that was her first meeting, you know, of this person, because that person wanted to be in home, you know.
Jeepers,
it wasn't people weren't just nipping back and forth like
and that's interesting now about the dress, because we seem to think like we're sending pictures to WhatsApp or Google or something, you know, photographs and that, but that she wouldn't have seen her, and it was a way of knowing her. Jeepers, and it's hard in modern day world to kind of, but it's interesting to hear all these things, because it gives you a look at life then, you know, and what people were going through. And
but people were clever too, like, you know, the way they'd figure out things like that. And also, we often say this, you know, about texts or whatever, when you'd meet someone, you had to meet them because you couldn't say, I'm running 5 minutes late or whatever, you know what I mean? You had to be there.
These definitely, But you see, there's a cleverness. I think there's an inherent thing in us all that if plan A doesn't work, we'll go plan B. So they had a way of figuring everything out.
Yeah.
They were able to manage the times they were in, I suppose.
Yeah.
Whereas now, if you said to someone, look, I'll send you a green jacket and have that on you, they'd be thinking, oh, like that one, there's something wrong with her. But you know, it's we adjust to everything and we cope, I suppose.
I'm just reminded of another story now. This is my own story. When I went to America, I was 18 and I went for a summer over there. So I used to caddy in the Waterville Golf Links, and I was invited over by a golfer. When you think about it, I went way over for a month, and when one golfer heard I was going over, he invited me to another place. So I brought a friend of mine with me, and my cousin was to collect him. Didn't I tell her the wrong day? So he arrived in a day early, and he was around New York.
Oh, sick.
He just booked the hostel himself, but they found each other anyway.
Oh, my God.
He had very distinctive coloured hair, so she was able to find him that way. He was the only person with that colour hair in New York, so she was able to find him. But getting back to Peg Sayers, what's your relationship to Peg Sayers?
I'll tell you, my overall kind of relationship, my overall image of Peg is that, God bless her, but a woman, the hardship of her life, and I don't want to kind of be, you know, all agonic about it, because I'm sure people say she was quite witty and sharp as well. But, you know, even thinking of her, the Blasket Islands, and I know that some of her children died when they were only babies, I think, and did her son, did one, I think one of her sons fell off the cliffs and was killed, and God bless us. But, do you know, it's kind of, again, trying to put your head back into, I mean, where she was coming from and the life that she lived, and it's the hardship. And I know for a fact, like, that it's hard, and I know it's not on the school curriculum anymore, but very hard for young people to kind of even connect with a Peg Sayers living that life and telling her story as it were. But, because one of my own children, she was convinced, no, it was a bit of maybe kind of, Mom, you know, I think she was a fictitious character, and she was preparing for the Leaving Cert, and I said, seriously, Sandra? And she said, no, no one could have lived like that. And she found it very, you know, that Ladrona kind of the sadness.
Yeah.
But you see, the generational gaps, she couldn't kind of credit that someone actually lived like that.
Yeah.
Couldn't, you know. But there's one thing about Peg Sayers that I have to say is that she'll never, like, I know God rest her soul and that, but she'll never die away because she's embedded into Irish society and people talk about her every so often. So she's there forever, like, in her book.
It's a sad thing, right, because she's kind of associated with the Irish language and the bad things about it, isn't it?
Yeah,
like, you know, God, Irish in school, and they just bring up her name. It's used as a description almost.
That's it. That they connect that, and because of this ongoing kind of struggle, I suppose people have with learning Irish, they, you know, if they find something then that they can hone in on and sort of say, oh, don't talk to me about Irish. And I remember Peg Sayers, never again want to hear that. So it's kind of, there's two things there. Is there a difficulty maybe with the language, and then they're inclined to, Peg is the easy target there, I think, you know.
Personification of it almost,
yeah. I think Brian McMahon, did he do a translation of the Peg? I think he did.
Yeah.
And but it's just to imagine, I mean, the life and just the lifestyle and all that hardship. And talking about, you know, when you're saying about the way people cope, I mean, she lived her life, and that was the life she lived, as you know, to put it that way, and that's what she had to do. But there was the hardship and the sadness, and I know where you're coming from about, like, I don't think of her as a very, sometimes now, if I was talking to my daughter, I know I might be a bit cross.
Like about Naresh.
But I might be a bit cross about something. And she'd say, Mom, do you know what? You're starting to sound like Peg Sayers. So it's like, but there was a thing she would still say, like, Avama Colleen.
Yeah.
Do you know? But there was funny bits in the story
and,
of Peg
and
as
that's,
well.
And that's what I suppose, you know, we talk about the 150 years of dead as well.
Yeah.
That's what should be celebrated as well, and that shouldn't be forgotten, is that side of her should be you know promoted as well.
I think that in her entirety, like, that we shouldn't just associate her and say, oh no, don't mention Peg Sayers because that means Irish and I don't know Irish and I found it hard. Just separate the two in a sense.
Yes.
You're right.
Yeah, very good. Just to let people know, they're asking about the Connor Pass. It will be reopened at 12:30. That's Roy Dingle is on today, so it's closed the month, but it'll be reopened at 12:30, so you can plan your journey around that now. Bernadette Nuida is going to stay with us because we are speaking of poetry, and I let her unveil who her poet is after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry, brought to you in association with Sean Lynch and John O'Rahilly, Hogan's Funeral Home, Tralee.
Yeah, and I hope you're enjoying the programme. If you want to text or WhatsApp, 083 300 3300. Hi, hi, Joe. Charles here, enjoying your show again. On the Scaravine, my mother always said during that period from mid-April to mid-May, you can get all sorts of weather, from nice warm weather to very cold wintry type weather like hail and late frost. It's usually May you get caught with those few wintry days that catch you on the hop. Thanks a million for that. Charles, happy birthday to Ollie O'Sullivan, Port McGee, 11 today. Enjoy from Nan, Grandad and all the Drummond gang. And in the Scaravine, that is, I don't know, the way the weather is at the moment, I believe you. In like a, what is it, it marches in like a lamb out, in like a lion out like a lamb.
The
lion is still around.
The lion didn't die down yet.
No, the lamb is still hiding from the lion.
Did you ever hear that expression, don't change a clout till May's out?
No.
Do you know,
don't change a cloud
till May is out.
What does that mean?
In other words, you can get any kind of weather, you know, the cold weather doesn't go like, we just take the good days when they come and deal with the bad ones,
I
suppose.
It's a good metaphor for life, isn't it?
Tis.
Yeah.
Tis.
Now you have your poet for Speaking of Poetry, another good one, Bernadette. Tell us who it is.
Yes. This poet, Derek Mahon. very well known and has written volumes and volumes of poetry, but just like we always kind of do, say a little bit about him.
Yeah.
He was born in Belfast in the early 40s, I think it was in 1941, and his dad worked in the Harland and Wolff Shipping and his mom worked in a local mill, so that's just again, and he was an only child, that's another.
Yeah, that's famous shipping company.
It is.
The building the ships, yeah.
But he went to primary school obviously in Belfast, and after there he went to a kind of, what is it called, the Royal Belfast Academical Institution, Royal Academy, I think I'll say if I'm saying that again, because that one, you know, trip me up. But, and I would imagine, Joe, that that would be something in terms of age anyway to be the equivalent of our secondary schools, because of age wise now, yes, you know, after primary school.
Yeah.
So, but when he was in the Royal Academy, the Belfast Academy, it became clear that he had an interest in poetry and literature, because he started contributing pieces to, you know, they had a school magazine and all of that. So, and in fact, he was only 17 when he won his first award for poetry.
Whoa.
So he was in it from the beginning,
yeah,
if you know what I mean.
He wasn't a late start.
No, he was not. But he left the Belfast Academy anyway, and he went to Dublin, and he studied French, English and philosophy in Trinity. And there he would have met people now like the likes of Evan Boland and Brendan Kennelly and all of those. But he wasn't, in terms of, very academic, but I'd say in terms of, how would I put this now, not a very settled student. I think overall, and I'll come back to this, he was a man that was very, maybe troubled,
yeah,
you know, he had a lot of personal stuff, but
yeah,
he did get called in a few times about lack of attendance at Trinity, and I think he caused disruption during exam time, so he was thrown out a couple of times and brought back. So he wasn't the most diligent of,
yes,
students in that sense.
Yeah.
But anyway, he went to Sorbonne then in Paris, I think, after finishing Trinity, and a lot of them go there.
Yeah.
I know there's Maura Vauquentin, a few that we've talked about.
Yeah.
So
is that the romantic notion of it, is it?
I think it's kind of to be in the heart of, you know, I don't know if it's the same nowadays, the literary scene.
Yeah.
And all of that kind of stuff, where they'd sit around all day in cafes. At least that's the image we have,
yeah,
discussing literature and the
smoking
finer points.
Cigarettes and
yeah,
drinking wine. And
yeah. Exactly. And the finer points of poetry, yeah, and what was in and what was out. That,
yeah,
kind of thing. That's the impression I get anyway.
Yeah.
Wouldn't know firsthand, of course.
We'll head off to Paris, though,
we'll
there
check
next
it out.
Week. But I suppose that kind of makes sense to kind of go to an environment like that. You know, you hear, yeah, about Silicon Valley for computer tech people, and, you know,
yeah,
there's places that people kind of hover to,
well,
for like minded people. Yeah,
yeah, to get the flavour of it, I suppose,
yeah,
and to be right immersed in it,
yeah,
I suppose, you know. So, yeah, but anyway, they did that. And
I get the feeling it's not for you, Bernadette.
No,
I don't think we're going to go to Paris with
no,
next week.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so, Joe. But in terms of his poetry then, you know, he focused a lot, and you could say this, I suppose, about any poet, on human nature, and there was always a sense of loneliness and that alienation. And to use his own words, he said that it was important for him to be on the edge of society looking in. Now, he was an only child, maybe that was an element in that factor, maybe it was just the way his makeup as a person.
Yeah.
Do you know, it's very hard to define anyway why people are the way they are, but
yeah,
he looked deeply into kind of the society and maybe the dark side of society as he saw it. And I suppose you could have said of anyone like that, a lot of what we see is based upon our own thinking, how we interpret it. And then he was a deep and serious thinker, but if we were to go into the question of what influences our individual thinking, that's kind of a,
yeah,
story for another,
yeah,
day, I suppose. But there's something, and this amuses me, you know, this thing about free verse and poetic form and strict adherence to that, you know, he wasn't a fan, he didn't embrace free verse, and he wasn't a fan of it. But there were two other well-known poets, Seamus Heaney and Michael Longley, also from the north of Ireland, and himself, Derek Mahon. And at one stage, they were labelled the tight-arsed trio. because they didn't want to entertain, you know, their strict adherence to, we'll say, the original, the old poetic form. But that really amuses me. Like,
tight-arsed trio.
So, but anyway, if you look too, I suppose, at poetry, and we were talking there now about almost not a forgotten time, but an era long gone. Everything evolves, you know, and society, we would think now, well, definitely the society we're living in, if you compare it now to Peg Sayre's, what,
yeah,
you were talking about there earlier, like, has evolved into a much freer. And I think the same thing was bound to happen to poetry, because, you know, everything evolves, nothing stays as it was. But, I mean, you hear, like, there's any kind of structure of a poem is okay nowadays in terms of it's acceptable, but still adhering to.
And I meant to just clarify for some people, free verse, what do you mean,
you know,
by
people,
that?
Some people call it the prose poem.
Yes.
But not to say, like, if I wrote a big page of stuff here now and handed it to you,
yeah,
And I say, like you'd say, that's prose. You could throw it back and say, no, give me a poem.
Yeah.
So like, you're still adhering to maybe poetic language, yes, poetic techniques in a sense.
Yeah.
There can still be internal rhyme inside, and you know, what we call yeah. prose poem, free
that's
verse.
So you can define a
you
poem.
You can define it, yeah, yeah, yes. Language has a lot to do with it and so on. Mm. But, so anyway, he was a restless character because he travelled around a lot, and he worked actually, and this was now after his college and his third level college education and that, but he went off to several cities in the likes of the USA and Canada, and he seems very unsettled. Do you know that he wasn't settling anywhere, and he was moving around. Maybe he was troubled about something, I don't know, and I don't want to suggest that he was either. Yeah. But he never really, and he did settle in London for a number of years. He never really came back to Belfast to live. I think there was some he did for maybe a year teaching, but after that, that would have been his early life. He came back there to visit, but never again to live there. And I think wherever he went, Belfast stayed with him.
Mm.
I suppose we always keep where we were born, and it does stay with us. But there's a poem called Afterlives. And this is kind of, I think his poetry is first class. That's just my opinion now, maybe, yeah. you know. But I'm going to read, I won't read it all because it's very long, but I'll read the last two stanzas yeah. and it brings in the Belfast and his connection to it.
Yeah.
So, and I step ashore in a fine rain to a city so changed by 5 years of war. I scarcely recognise the places I grew up in, the faces that try to explain. But the hills are the same, grey-blue above Belfast. Perhaps, if I'd stayed behind and lived it bomb by bomb, I might have grown up at last and learned what is meant by home. I think that's powerful.
Yeah, it is.
I
yeah.
think, you know. And there was, again, my opinion, there was an accuracy in his language, in his poetry, I think, you know, that his images, you couldn't kind of sidestep them because, you know, they would hit you, you know, and he did write a lot about society. But to me, that's like a regret
yeah.
and a longing and the place that he once called home.
Yeah.
And of course, he's acknowledging the awful troubled times, but yeah. lived it bomb by yeah, bomb.
Lived it bomb by bomb. Yeah, that's brilliant.
Stay what yeah. you like, you know.
Yeah, like, you know, near Town I Love So Well, it's kind of a similar yeah. kind of a thing, but yeah. that's yeah. brilliant in its like, own right there, isn't it? Yeah.
He didn't go into kind of what he would have seen and known about all the killings and, you know, the bomb by bomb bit, that opens up a much bigger picture yeah. in those just that line, I yeah. think, anyway,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
But no, he had a poetry was definitely in him.
Yeah.
And
did I read somewhere that his parents didn't want him to become a poet or like, and is that where this rebellious kind of unease with home or like, you know?
Very possibly, you see, they may yeah. have had a different path in life for him.
Yeah.
And then, of course, look, you know, every young person feels it's their duty to rebel anyway because parents know nothing. You know, everyone goes through that phase. But it could have been that he was kind of saying, I'll go, you know, this is what I want. But if he was writing poetry at that young an age and winning awards, like, I mean, it was in yeah. him. I don't think anyone could have, you know, quelled that
yes.
in him,
yeah,
I don't
yeah.
think.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know.
Very good. Just to give a message out here, there are people out picking litter picking on the roads today for the county cleanup. Would drivers please slow down? So yeah, just be very mindful there. And even yesterday evening, there people are out picking litter and doing a fantastic job, and well done to everyone who's involved in that. But just be careful, yeah. Just be a bit more mindful that there's more people, and you know they're bending down to pick things up and things like that. So give them a wide berth and take your time and just be mindful of that because they're doing a great job keeping our county clean. We're talking about Derek Mahon.
But another thing that Derek Mahon said about Belfast, Joe, and I think maybe he was trying to justify or excuse his own disentanglement from it in a way, but he said like that he had, his background was, you know, the Protestant liberal grammar school education, they were his words, and he felt that somehow that gave him the notion that he wasn't implicated in what was going on. I think that's huge.
Yeah.
But he knew that he was, but he kind of felt that he couldn't, you know. Yeah. I think he was like someone standing, you know, a foot on either stool, you know. I think that poor man was that way. But definitely poetry was his forte. And but he also worked like things. He did a lot of translations and he adapted other people's work for stage and television and that. And so he was brilliant. He did have a troubled personal life. And he's written quite a long poem about it. And I'd love to read it.
Yeah.
Now, he had alcoholism was one of the things that, you know, that he suffered and struggled with, I should say, and he did overcome it eventually in later life. And his marriage, I think he had two children with his wife and he had one, a third child with his partner and all of that. And that was his own personal stuff. But he's written a poem called Dawn at St. Patrick's, and it's really telling you everything that was inside in him, you know, at that time. There's an old statue in the courtyard that weeps like Niobe, its sorrow in stone. The griefs of the ages she has made her own. Her eyes are rain-washed but not hard. Her body is covered in mould, the garden overgrown. One by one, the first lights come on. Those that haven't been on all night. Christmas. The harshly festive has come and gone. No snow, but the rain pours down in the first hour before dawn, before daylight. Swift's home for fools and mad has become an administrative block. Much there has remained unchanged for many long year. Stairs, chairs, Georgian windows, shafting light and dust of the satirist. But the real hospital is a cheerful and modern extension at the back, hung with respectful reproductions of Duffy, Klee and Brack. Television, Russian fiction, snooker with the staff, a snifter of Lucozade, a paragraph of Newsweek or the Daily Mail are my daily routine during the festive season. They don't lock the razors here as in Bodwit Hall. We've remained upright, though to be frank, the Christmas dinner scene with grown men in their festive gear was a sobering sight. I watched the last planes of the year go past, silently climbing a cloud-lit sky. Earthbound, soon I'll be taking a train to Cork and trying to get back to work at my sea-lit Fortitude desk in the turf smoky dusk. Meanwhile, next door, a visiting priest intones to a faithful dormitory. I sit on my Protestant bed, a make-believe existentialist, and stare at the clouds of unknowing. We style as best we may our private destiny, or so it seems to me as I chew my thumb and try to figure out what brought me to my present state. An educated man, a man of consequence, no bum, but one who has hardly grasped what life is about, if anything. My children far away don't know where I am today in a Dublin asylum, with a paper whistle and a mince pie. My bits and pieces making a home from home. I pray to the rain clouds that they never come where their lost father lies, that their mother thrives, and that I may measure up to them before I die. Soon, a new year would be here demanding, as before, modest proposals, resolute resolutions, a new leaf, new leaves. This is the story of my life, the story of all lives everywhere, mad fools, whatever we are in here, out there. Light and sane, I shall walk down to the train into that world whose sanity we know, like Swift, to be a fiction and a show. The clouds part. The rain ceases. The sun casts now upon everyone its ancient shadow.
Wow.
I think he's like as if he's told his life. Definitely the struggles and the personal, you know, he doesn't want his children to see him in St. Patrick's, and it was a huge problem. He did overcome it, which I'm very glad to say, in later life.
But that's like a scene from the movie, and then putting context in it as well.
Yeah.
It's very clever. And I can see now what you're talking about in between the kind of the rules of poetry, but then kind of going outside of it and then back into it again.
Yeah,
he kind of marries the two. They don't lock the razors here was somewhere, wasn't it?
Yeah, that would grip you, wouldn't it? You know, like they did in somewhere else. And, you know, he's kind of given it like it is, that, you know, grown men with, you know, paper whistle and a paper hat, and that's how he spent that Christmas, you know. Yeah. And he doesn't want his children to see him, and he's wishing his wife the best. She must have suffered as well because of his, you know, his alcoholism and that. But it's great, a great man, a great poet, I should say, that's able to throw out something that must have been such a huge trauma side and throw it out like that into a poem.
Yeah, you know? We're going to hear more about Derek Mahan. Bernadette Nureda is here with us for our Speaking of Poetry monthly slot. We're going to take a break with more after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you in association with Sean Lynch and John O'Rahilly, Hogan's Funeral Home, Tralee.
066-712-3666. Text the WhatsApp 083-300-3300. It's actually, Bernadette, never cast a clout till May is out. Grew up with that saying, someone said. You had never cast a clout, but maybe you're right too.
Oh, clout.
Yeah.
Clout. But the cloud and the clout now are two different things.
Yeah, but never cast a clout. That means you shouldn't be casting clouts anyway.
What?
That means don't hit someone, is it, till May is out?
So
you can have free for all then during the summer, is it?
Do you see the interpretation of words? That's why words are fascinating. Because you see, the clout, I would have think of it as clobber, the clothes we wear. Clout.
Okay.
Oh, then again, you could hit someone in the clout, all right. You're right about that too.
I
think no.
I better not talk about getting clouts growing up or anything, or my mother will be on to me.
Exactly.
So back to our featured poet today. It's Derek Mahan, and you've another one of his wonderful poems here.
Yeah, oh, I mean, he's well known for poetry, and God knows he wrote over 20 volumes of poetry and published. But The Disused Shed in County Wexford, that's a poem I think that people would relate to, and I love it because there's a lot of everyday images attached to it. And might be worth mentioning that he wrote this poem in 1973, and I think that was about a year after Bloody Sunday.
Okay, you know, yeah.
But anyway, so even now there are places where a thought might grow. Peruvian mines worked out and abandoned to a slow clock of condensation. An echo trapped forever, and a flutter of wildflowers in the lift shaft. Indian compounds where the wind dances, and a door bangs with diminished confidence. Lime crevices behind rippling rain barrels, dog corners for bone burials, and a disused shed in County Wexford. Deep in the grounds of a burnt-out hotel, among the bathtubs and the wash basins, a thousand mushrooms crowd to a keyhole. This is the one star in their firmament, or frames a star within a star. What should they do there but desire, so many days beyond the rhododendrons, with the world waltzing in its bowl of cloud? They've learned patience and silence, listening to the rooks querulous in the high wood. They have been waiting for us in a feature of vegetable sweat since Civil War days, since the gravel-crunching interminable departure of the expropriated mycologist. He never came back, and lies since then as a keyhole rusting gently after rain. Spiders have spun, flies dusted to mildew, and once a day, perhaps, they have heard something. A trickle of masonry, a shout from the blue, or a lorry changing gear at the end of the lane. There have been deaths, the pale flesh flaking into the earth that nourished it, and nightmares, born of these and the grim dominion of stale air and rank moisture. Those nearest the door grow strong. Elbow room, elbow room. The rest, dim in a twilight of crumbling utensils and broken pitchers, groaning for their deliverance, have been so long expectant there is left only the posture. A half century without visitors in the dark. Poor preparation for the cracking lock and creak of hinges. Magi, moonmen, powdery prisoners of the old regime. Web-throated, stalk-like triffids, racked by drought and insomnia. Only the ghost of a scream at the flashbulb firing squad will wake them, which shows there is life yet in their feverish forms. Grown beyond nature now, soft food for worms, they lift frail heads in gravity and good faith. They are begging us, you see, in their wordless way, to do something, to speak on their behalf, or at least not to close the door again. Lost people of Treblinka and Pompeii, save us, they seem to say. Let the God not abandon us, who have come so far in darkness and in pain. We too had our lives to live. You, with your light meter and relaxed itinerary, let not our naive labours have been in vain. That poem really grips me.
Mm.
And isn't it an interesting thing, because we were talking, again, we're bringing Peg Sayers is coming into everything. Do you know, the generational thing, I can connect that poem to our own images of maybe the famine ships.
Mm.
And the people crowded down into the bowels of the ship, maybe hoping for a chink of light.
Mm.
And I can even bring it skipping forward to present day, where we see the televised images of the boats crowded when people are fleeing and they're out on the water and they're all saying, save us, you know. So,
mm.
And he uses such, what do you call it? Everyday images, like who hasn't heard a door banging the yeah. shed, you know,
yeah.
the clatter and that kind of thing, but the desperation as well. So I think I think his poetry is beautiful, and I won't, you know, deny that, and I think the accuracy, but that particular one, and I think John Banville has said that 'twas the best single poem written since Yeats. You know,
oh.
that's kind of a great kind
sure,
of
if that's his legacy alone, that's some...
Yeah, yeah. exactly. But mm. I think it's fabulous. There's so much in it,
mm.
and it can connect with any era, in a way. You know, there's images in that you can connect with images like of any era and the desperation and everything else.
Yeah, he passed away in 2020.
Yeah, he went to Kinsale in 2003, I think, Joe, and he settled there, and he passed away. He was late 70s, I think, and but he had achieved so much, you know. He worked in London for the BBC, did a lot of translations, and his accolades, I couldn't even begin, because there are so many, you know, to take forever. He really was acknowledged as a worthy, you know, worthy poet and mm. all the rest of it, but he did a lot of, you know, I think I might have mentioned this, you know, he adapted plays and the writer's work, like for stage and television, and he's, you know, he was just one of those, like, he, I think, oh yes, there is something that I would like to get in here. You know, he did get 2 honorary doctorates from NUI and from Trinity. But there's something there that he declined. I have to get this right now. He declined to be considered for an OBE or for the Queen's Gold Medal for Poetry.
Very good. Well, that is Derek Mahon, again, another honoree into Bernadette the Arena's, speaking of poetry, Hall of Fame. I don't know, we'd have to go up with some kind of a name for it. An honoree inductee into that. Anyway, Bernadette, as always, brilliant. You know, it just strikes me about some poets, like you mentioned them, like everyday imagery and small little things, but you kind of have to be, they have to be hyper aware of things, because sometimes you hear about a drop in a puddle and then it turns into a global, you know, they talk about something global about it.
I think there's an intensity of awareness, and poets notice other things that other people won't. I do think that, I believe
and
that.
And they find the extraordinary in the ordinary.
Yeah, exactly. That's the best way to sum it up, spot on.
Yeah, very good. Well, Bernadette, thanks a million for coming in. I look forward to who you'll bring along to us next month.
Thank you too, Joe Sloan.
Now, that's all we have time for. My thanks to Alana Diggan and Andrew Morrissey, who were on sound. Francis is on the way, so keep it here on Radio Kerry. I'll be back again next Saturday from 9 a.m. and we will be bringing you the Ring of Kerry Charity Cycle beneficiaries. We'll have them on the programme. Always look forward to hearing what they will bring, and lots of requests coming in, and Francis will get to them. And also hello to Patrick in Listowel. That's all we have time for. I'll talk to you again next Saturday. Until then, look after yourself and take care.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry, brought to you in association with Sean Lynch and John O'Rahilly, Hogan's Funeral Home, Tralee.